Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Is 6.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. Mr. Joe Goldberg is here, so it's another spy day.
It's a spy day. It's a protect my garden from the rabbits day.
Yeah. Well, you guys all know each other, right? Spies?
We all know each other.
Yeah, like you kind of communicate, you know, mind to mind.
Well, talk about mind. We have an expert on mind control. That's probably a good topic.
Yeah, yeah.
Gavin's the man.
He's gonna teach you how to control the minds of the world.
Well, he's mind control, body language, all those really cool arts, dark arts of espionage.
Exciting. My nipples are hard.
So, how do we know what difference does it make?
Well,
constant state of affairs.
Yeah, well, it's important to me. You see, that means it's working. I'm aiming it.
Sad state.
Yeah, I got to cut some glass here. No, so Gavin Stone, thank you for being here.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
So, Gavin, how did you get into that field? Because this is true. Like we're talking about, you do have the history of being into intelligence and covert operations, security, and you've done a book on. Body language and reading it and stuff like that. So where did that come from for you?
So the mind control side of things came from my interest in NLP, which is just a great little area. I'm a qualified practitioner in that, which I learned a lot from Richard Bandler, who invented it. And the original theory came from wanting to look at why some psychiatrists got brilliant results and psychologists got brilliant results in an hour or two, and others, after years of therapy, still weren't getting a breakthrough. And they modelled the original kind of NLP or neuro-linguistic programming around that. And my interest in it was, how can this be used and implemented in my world?
I bet you like the old Avengers TV show from the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
I was watching that all day. Knowing that you're going to be on. I had to get into the English.
The prisoner. What, was that the one where he was in like a town or a village and he kept trying to escape?
The village. It's a classic. It's a must watch. 17 episodes of Patrick McGoohan.
Long time ago. Wow, that brings back memories.
Yeah, the good old days. Make Britain great again.
we're still working on that.
Yeah, it's unfinished business, we'll just say that.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of an interesting lifestyle, and you've got your bachelor in psychology, I see. So you've really been into this thing. And number 28 in the world as body language expert. So that's why I haven't got any camera on today. You can't, if you saw what I was wearing and what I looked like, you'd probably, you know, well, you would get
something?
Off. Yeah. You'd probably
I'm shocked
be off
by that.
Yeah. It'd be like, that's it. No more. I can't do this.
I kind of get that a lot. I get people that, you know, I talk to them and they say, so you're a body language expert. And I say, yeah. And they fold their arms and they come, so what am I thinking? I say, I'm not psychic. I'm, you know, I read body language. It's like, you know, I can get an idea of whether you're comfortable or uncomfortable with a subject. But, you know, I don't suddenly turn into, you know, some kind of psychic who can speak to your granddad and, who's been passed away for 20 years and know all your thoughts from your childhood.
Oh, well, then what good is it?
I know, yeah. I'm still working on it.
So, Gavin, how did you incorporate body language and all your intelligence and consulting and all that sort of stuff? How did it play?
And if you can imagine, well, in the world of secrets, it's really important to know when somebody is being truthful with you and when they're not. And you kind of very quickly get to grips with the assets that you can trust and the ones that you think are just kind of adding and sprinkling a few little extra bits and pieces on for a little bit of extra cash or motivation of whatever means. So it doesn't take you long to start spotting little things and going, that's not baseline for him. When he's telling me that story, there's differences from when he's telling me the, the kind of the other information that I'm after. And that's kind of, where it came in useful in that world for me. But it's something I've done since childhood, but then kind of developed and learned about it later on in life, and then as I've learned, and I've gone, so that's why I've been spotting that, and that's what, you know, so kind of I was doing it first and then realized why I was doing it afterwards.
And since you have the ability to mingle with and get results from undesirables, so you're mingling with some today.
Yes. Yeah. I have a good doodle going.
Yeah. Well, how does that work? So do you have to be able to fit in with all kinds of people.
Yeah.
In all kinds of areas. How is it you go about that?
One of the most useful ones, and this is going to sound really, really crazy, what we call football over here, what you guys call soccer, it's almost like a universal. There's so many things, there's certain things that everybody around the world, like the number one favorite is food. Everybody has to eat. Everybody has their favorite foods and dishes. So you've always got that as a, if all else fails, food is your kind of last resort. But football is a brilliant way, no matter where you go in the world, to be able to mingle it and get involved in crowds. And I've done it. I've been stuck in foreign villages up in the mountains, and I've been in a bar, and I don't speak a word of their language. They don't speak any English. And it's just a simple case of you cheer when they cheer, you boo when they boo, and the next thing you know, they're buying you drinks and meals, and you know, and that's like a very short version, but it's very easy to kind of utilize what's going on around you as a tool to be able to build rapport very quickly with these people.
So how'd you incorporate that into your books? Spy book. I'm going to write to the spy book. Yeah.
I haven't really gone too much into the rapport in the first book. There's a lot of tradecraft revelations in there. Every kind of, you know, fifth page, there's another tradecraft revelation that isn't usually in, and I've done it in a very unique way. It's written in novel form, but there's also these sections where the tradecraft is explained. So, and this comes back from when I used to read, when I first started reading novels years ago. If I read something that I knew nothing about, an area I knew nothing about, say, a book on a paramedic, and they say, he got the HRT 11 and he put it on the backwards flipping device or whatever, and I'm like, what? I'm lost. And I thought, well, if I didn't know the things I knew, if I picked up any military book or spy book and started reading it, would I know what they're talking about if I didn't already know? And the answer a lot of the times was no. And I thought that's probably something that I could work on. So I wrote this book, and when he uses a bit of tradecraft, there's like a section which is in italics, and it explains exactly what it's done and why the method's moved, and then goes back to the story. So it's almost like a field manual as well as a story in one.
So now that last book you got, it's called The Unforgiven Spy, and it's book one in the Spies for Hire series. So what is that series going to be?
That's going to be an ongoing series. So the main character in the book, Jensen, he's a former contractor. He's done a lot of the things very similar to myself. He's worked for different intelligence agencies, governments, private clients, etc. And there are a lot of parallels with his life and my life in regards to He has a daughter and realizes that he's put his hand in the fire a few too many times, and if he keeps doing it sooner or later, he's going to get burned. So he decides to step back away from the world of kind of, you know, spies and contracting and anything like that, and be a stay-at-home dad. In fact, the working title, when I first started writing it, the working title was actually Spy at Home Dad, and it was meant to be more of a comedy than, you know, a very tongue-in-cheek comedy more so than a very serious novel. And it did actually get very, very serious very quickly, so that was why it all changed. So yeah, but it, basically, his past comes back to haunt him, his wife and daughter get kidnapped, and he has to team up with a couple of friends and go and kind of get them back and bring the whole thing to an end. So, but I'm lucky, touch wood, my wife and daughter have never been kidnapped, that side of it, I've never had to deal with. Yep, yep. and luckily for me, you know, that's something I'm hoping never happens, but everything else in the book, absolutely everything, are things that I've either experienced firsthand in the field or in training or running simulations, or and maybe not all in the way that they happened in the book, but everything is written from experience. So that really helps with the kind of continuity.
So there are a lot of reasons to write a book or an espionage book. You have an interesting background. You just explained that everything in the book sort of happened, maybe not in that way. Why did you write the book? Was it to do something new, to explain those things, to entertain? Why does Gavin write this book after your career?
I think that it goes back to, I mean, when I stopped kind of working and taking an active role in the industry, I wasn't sure what to do, and I would tell a lot of stories, you know, to my in-laws and that kind of thing, and you know, they'd find them interesting, and they'd say, you should write a book, you know, and I didn't even think about writing a book until, you know, they suggested it. And I tried several times. It was an absolute disaster. In fact, the first one I got told was more like a report than a book. It took me a long, long time and many, many different attempts. And the first attempt was more like an autobiographical kind of my life on paper. And the first one I did, when I finished it, I read it back, I thought, this is going to start a world war. If I put this out, I can't do it. There's too much. I need to water it down. So I did a second attempt, which was that boring after I watered it down that even I was falling asleep reading it. And I was about midway through the third attempt and I thought, you know what? How about I write this as fiction? And I did courses. I took a lot of classes. I learned a lot of things. And believe it or not, the background in body language really, really helped. When I was learning to write descriptively, I could visualize what somebody would do body language wise and kind of write that in, which helped give a real level of realism to the characters. So that's my recommendation for anybody whoever is deciding to go into the life of a writer, is start by doing a body language class. It will be extremely helpful for you. And several, many, many, many failed attempts later, I eventually got a manuscript in place. Many, many, many rejections later, I teamed up with a friend of mine from MI6, a really great guy who I'm good friends with, and he said, look, traditional publishing is something that you don't have the same control and there's not the same kind of rewards as there used to be. It's not as good unless you're a really established author. If you're new in the game, it's not as worthwhile as self-publishing right now, where you have a lot more control and a lot more rights. So I decided to self-publish. I got a lot of celebrities and people and help on board that helped me to promote it, and had a really good boost with the debut fiction novel.
Well, that's great. Now, are you Jensen, basically? Is that what you're trying to say? Same things happened and stuff, but you've kind of, you know, like you said, you watered it down, and of course you had to change some things to protect the innocent, but are you basically that character?
I wish I could be. If you took me having my best day where everything just lands in place and just works out perfectly for me and I'm really having one of those great days, that would be Jensen on an average day. Unfortunately, most days for me aren't really like that. So he's a fictional character of everything I'd like to be, but unfortunately not quite there. I wish I was.
So when you go through all these manuscripts and you take the classes and you come out the other side with the ready to self-publish the book, did you start with the character of Jensen? Did you start with the plot? How did you see this developing? Through developing a character or developing a plot?
Yeah, so, I started loosely with the character of Jensen, and his friends Marshall and Darius were written in because in my life there has been particular jobs. Most of them I generally have been tasked to do on my own, but I do know there's a couple of gentlemen that I can approach if ever I need to and say, look, I need some help with this, and they would be there to back me up. So in this instance, I wrote it loosely based on Jensen, and then again, what I wanted to do was keep everything as close to my own experiences as possible. You know, if there's a place mentioned in the book, I've been there. I've kept continuity so accurate. If I say there's a code to a gate in a military installation, that is the code to the gate, or was at the time of printing. And so writing from my own experience, even though the story itself isn't what happened to me, all the little bits of things that have happened throughout my life and my training and my working and that kind of thing. And that's where I kind of started to say, well, how can I use a bit of my life that happened here and a bit that happened there and put all these little bits and pieces together and make them fit into a story. And also make it a story that the reader wants to find out what happens and how the ending, you know, kind of how it all comes to a happy ending.
And your setting, how important is that in the book? Are you writing it as detailed as a character, or is it kind of more just background?
I made the mistake, which I didn't realize till long down the line, rather than writing it from a kind of third-party perspective of a, I believe it's called an omniscient perspective. So you're looking at everything from an observing point of view. You probably know this a lot better than I do. And I didn't realize till after I started writing it that way, that it was done, and unfortunately it was too late to change it. But yeah, the majority of it is from the kind of the angle of primarily of Jensen and his tackling of the problem that he's presented with.
Interesting. So do you kind of have something you want to get across to the reader? Like, is there some underlying point, and will there be to each one of the books in the series?
It's given a point of view which isn't normally taken, because usually in the spy world, you know, it's your James Bond, MI6, or somebody's working for the CIA or one of the three letter agencies, and they're working either directly for them or of a sub-branch. And this is done showing that there's actually a completely different world out there that isn't spoken about much, and it's actually about 70% of the intelligence community, and that's the contractors. And contractors, unfortunately, they've got a really negative connotation attached to the label, and people straight away think of the likes of Blackwater and go, oh, yeah, no, you know, we don't particularly like the idea of that. But there are contractors who work behind desks, who are software engineers. There are also contractors that do the things that I used to do, where we would go out and it'd be a human intelligence gathering assignment and that kind of thing. So there's very different levels, and it's done usually by the station chief or something. They will have the discretion to hire who they want. And if you've got a good reputation, you know, your phone carries on ringing. So it's taken from that angle rather than the classic, I work for the government, I've got the weight of the government behind me, I've got, you know, whatever I need at my disposal. This guy hasn't. Everything is improvise, adapt and overcome. Everything is use whatever you've got, you know, MacGyver style, and do whatever it takes with no backup, nobody else looking after you, you know, no government departments helping you out with satellite images or anything like that. You are pretty much how it is in reality, on your own.
So, as a contractor, do you have to get pre-approval for what you write from someone? Do you have a secrecy agreement?
So because I've actually worked for the British government as well, I did have to sign the OSA and the Official Secrets Act. So by rights, I am bound to that, but I'm not whereas certain people like MI6 and that kind of thing, and MI5, if they write anything, they have to send it for pre-approval. Or I believe the CIA is the same.
They have to buy pre-approved.
Yeah, you got to get it pre-approved. I'm not bound to that. I can pretty much write what I want. But if I am found to be in breach of the OSA, then, you know, obviously I'd have to pay the price. So I don't have to go through the same system as most guys do and get it pre-approved. But I still do have to be reasonably careful as to what I put in there, content-wise.
I got to do a footnote here for all the agency people who are beating their heads against the law of notary people. It's not pre-approval. It's pre-publications review. They don't approve.
Yes.
It's review. So, okay, that's it. Don't yell at me, guys.
Yeah. And of course, I generally go off. My boss, he was absolutely brilliant. And his theory was, it's better to seek forgiveness than approval. With anything in life, he'd say, look, go and do it. And then afterwards, I'll call you in the office and shout at you and tell you you shouldn't have done it. And then you'll say sorry, and then you'll go out and do what the hell you want. He said, because if you ask me beforehand, the answer's going to be no. He said, and then it's a whole different action if I've already told you no and then you're going against orders. He said, but if you do it first, he said, then, you know, I'll call you in the office, we have a cup of tea, I'll shout at you. He said, you pretend to take it, and we go on and carry on doing our jobs.
Right, but Gavin, it's marketing. See, I want to put something in there for them so I can say, hey, the stuff that the agency did not want you to see, read my book, you know?
Yeah, in fact, I'm trying to get mine banned.
Yeah, do it. That's exactly right. The book they didn't want you to have.
Yeah, it's exactly what I'm working on. But funnily enough, what I did, I actually put a little something in there, and I don't know, are any of you guys Freemasons by any chance?
No.
So I'm not either. But I do know a lot about their industry for obvious reasons. And what I did is I put a little secret in there, a little Freemason's secret, nothing over the top, but enough to cause a little bit of a stir that people can find out and go, oh, wow, that's interesting. And it's now out in the public domain. And I thought one day, hopefully with a bit of luck, some Freemason will read this and go, oh, we've got to do something about this, and then call to get it banned. And then if that happens, there'll be no better publicity in the world than, you know, secret society calls for X-Spy's book to be banned. It'd be the perfect marketing tool.
Or you wake up in the, you know, family plot in the Midlands of England somewhere.
Yeah. There are any Freemasons listening.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, if you could do me a little favour, you know, you'll see it's obviously there. It tells you the word Freemasons and then it's all there. So, yeah, that would be much appreciated. Thank you.
Yeah, you'll find them on Twitter and Instagram. Go for it.
Yeah.
Now, buy the book first and then.
That's right. You need this and review it. And then you come and get it.
Yeah, yes. Then we want the complaint. We know what we're doing here.
Yeah.
How do you tackle dialogue then? How do you, between the characters and stuff, how do you write your dialogue? Is it from stuff you've heard in the business or seen, or do you just take it from Joe's book? Like what goes on?
I generally just go off what I do is I put the character in the position and then think, right, what would I say in this instance? You know, and if I were, if it was my friends that were with me, how would they reply? How would they react to this? And there's this brilliant kind of banter between the three characters, and they're constantly playing silly little tricks on each other. They've all got their own little journeys that they're going on, which is brilliant how it all works. And there's worries and concerns at times between the three of them, you know, as to what's going on. But they use this humour between them to kind of shield their real thoughts and fears, which is what humans do. Yes. And it's good how they all kind of gel together and they've got each other's backs. So, you know, it's all kind of done from, you know, how I've known things work in the industry and how, like, kind of, when I've worked with friends, how it's happened and what I've witnessed firsthand.
Yeah, I call that the MASH effect, the TV show movie.
Yeah.
You know, they use dark humor to get through the dark times. That's kind of how I think the agency existed when I was there. Did you know how your book was going to end and how it moves on to the next part of the series when you started it, when you were piecing it all together?
When I first started writing it, it was this particular version was a trilogy.
Right.
And I'd got in mind from the very beginning that it was a trilogy. And what I did is when I finished, book one, I'd already got the outlines for book two and three. And the theory was when book one was with the editor, I was then going to fill in the meat on the bones of book two and kind of have that ready to go. So as soon as book one was out, book two was getting edited and repeat the process. So I knew roughly what was going to happen in each one. So there are things in book one which may not seem relevant at the time, and the reader might think, okay, you never kind of answered the question with that, or, you know, I don't get the point of what happened there. But then in book two and book three, it all of a sudden becomes highly kind of obvious why these little events happened. And with the success of it and with everybody kind of, with the reaction that I got from it, I then decided why limit it to a trilogy? Why not make it an ongoing series? So yes, in answer to your question, yes, I did know exactly what was going to happen in books 1, 2, and 3 from start to finish. However, upon reviewing, after book 1 went out, upon reviewing book 2, I noticed that it wasn't story so much as a link to book 3. So we'd got like book 1 and book 3. Book 1 was okay, book 3 was great, and book 2 was just filling in the details and the gaps. So I've actually scrapped book 2 and I'm in the process of completely rewriting it from scratch. I'm about 2/3 of the way through. And just to make it, just to give it a bit more emotion, a bit more story, make it a bit more gripping, and make the reader have a story at the end of it where they want to then go on to read book 3 because they've enjoyed book 2 that much.
Do you have some sort of a, I don't know what they call it, a Bible or some sort of a thing that you keep all of the characters and kind of what goes on to them to keep track of it?
No, so it was something that I've been told to do by you know, the likes of Andy McNabb and one or two others, that they keep a Bible for their characters. And for me, I look at the fact that I kind of know the characters intimately because they are all based on real people. So I can look at the, you know, at Marshall, for example, and I can look at the real person that character's based on and go, right, when's his birthday? You know, what's his star sign? What, you know, and if I need to know something, I can actually ring him up. If I don't know, say, for instance, what kind of beer he drinks, I can say, hey, what kind of beer do you drink? Because you're about to have a pint of ale in a pub in Europe somewhere, you know, and he can tell me. So I do have that to my advantage. Like I say, they're loosely, very loosely based on real people.
So you know them intimately. You've slept with them all.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Threesomes and all sorts of things. Yeah.
Now we're getting there.
Yeah. That's
now we're getting to the real dirt.
And that's going to be enough.
That's going to be in the explicit version.
That's it. Yeah. That's the triple X rated version. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, make it into a mini series too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That'd be great. If there's anyone from Netflix listening, yeah, let's get it out there.
Stand in line, Gav. Yeah. Stand in line.
Oh, yeah. I'm not surprised.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I thought. Violence on the page. How is it you attack writing violence on the page? How is it you present your action and violence?
I've kind of learned by mistake that when there's a rapid action scene, the most important thing to do is slow it down. Because I found if you do the snappy short sentences of, then he did, and then that happened, and then this happened, and You go through it too quick, the action scene's over, and it's not descriptive enough. So what I do is I slow everything down. And so one fight scene might be 3 or 4 pages long where you've got the description of every bead of sweat and every, like, the usual kind of descriptive, you know, slippy skin and fingers and whatever you need to put in there. But enough balance of action so that you're mixing the description and the action in enough to make the reader kind of, you know, want to get to the next bit to find out what's happening. You know, is he going to choke this guy out? Is this guy going to, you know, get the knife and stab him? Is he, you know, whatever the case may be. Because I found if you write it too quick, it's a great big disappointment. And Joe, you probably know better than I do, especially with this kind of thing. But yeah, the longer you take to describe that action scene, the more you can do everything, you kind of freeze time of him drawing his fist back for the punch and get as much description in there before the punch makes contact. It certainly helps with kind of getting the reader to be as engaged as possible. And that's my opinion anyway. So it seems to have worked. So, Joe, you're the expert there.
No, I'm no expert, but it's interesting. Usually people say, because I write the snappy, the shorter sentences, but that when you're having action, I think shorter goes.
Mm-hmm.
It can still be a longer sequence, but I was taking notes on that saying, because I'm just starting rewriting my book right today, in fact. And I'm like, I'm going to check that out. Because sometimes I find that long fighting scenes, describing all that, so I'm like, okay, does he win? My eyes are scanning ahead, trying to find out where the knife goes.
Yeah.
But if you keep it short or vary it to the plot, you know, this moment requires a short, snappy fight scene. Mm-hmm. This one requires a longer Gavin scene. That's actually not a bad sort of variance to do to kind of fiddle with the pacing of the book.
Yeah.
I might work with that. But how do you deal with bad guys?
Oh, I love bad guys. Because a lot of writers, new writers, and I did exactly the same thing. They write the mistake of making a bad guy bad. And that's where they go so dreadfully wrong, because you've heard the saying, nobody's the villain in their own story. And the truth of the matter is, you know, these bad guys, nobody wakes up in the morning and goes, ooh, I'm evil. You know, they wake up with their own purpose, and it may not align with what everybody else wants and likes. And if you look at, like, the world's, you know, most infamous bad guys in fiction, like Darth Vader, for example, in his mind, he wasn't the bad guy. He wanted to restore order to the universe and build a Death Star and make everybody kind of, you know, stick to the rules and you know, kind of live a peaceful life. So for him, he wasn't a bad guy. So when I write the bad guy, I do it from a point of, you know, he didn't just get up and decide to be evil. You know, he's doing something to either avenge somebody or to change something for what is better in his mind and that kind of thing. And the trick is to make the bad guys that great that if ever it were to go to a Hollywood movie, the A-listers are screaming on I want to play the bad guy.
No, I mean, it's important to show the bad guy's intention.
Mm-hmm.
Or bad gal, I guess, whatever it is. I mean, it's important, I think, because then people understand them better.
Oh, yeah. The more character and purpose you can give to the bad guy, then the better. And, you know, and again, like I say, really, really, that was the mistake I made when I first started writing. I made these really bland bad guys, you know, where kind of, you know, the good guy comes along and kind of kills them. And what you've really got to do is you've really got to stack the odds. And again, this is something that I've learned over time. The bad guy has got to be a Goliath, and your hero has got to be a David. You know, you've got to be rooting for the underdog with this thing, and the odds have got to be so severely stacked against the protagonist that they say, how the hell is he going to do this? How the hell is he going to win this? And that alone, just that thought, makes them want to read to say, okay, I've got to see how he manages to bring this Goliath down.
Well, in that sense, then, are there things that you won't include as a theme or an issue that you just say, I can't put this in? In the current world, it's cancel culture, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But is there something that you say, you know, I don't want to touch this. This is too sensitive, or this is just not me. This represent what I believe, whatever. Do you have a list of those kind of things?
Not really a list, not per se like a written list. I mean, there are, with the tradecraft type of things, I do make a lot of revelations in the sense of there are things I probably haven't made it out into the public domain before, and the reader will come across tradecraft and go, wow, I didn't know you could do that, or I didn't know this was how this was done. So with that in mind, I decided that I'll put pretty much anything in the book except IEDs. And for those who don't know, that's improvised explosive device. There's no reason in my mind that anybody needs to know how to make an IED. Or like I say, for those who don't know, that's an improvised explosive device. That's a bomb, basically, in a backpack. I dare say if you look, you could Google how to make like a pressure cooker bomb or whatever. There's some idiot who will probably tell you. But for me, I thought I'm not putting that in or anything like that. There's plenty of other tradecraft in there, which is, you know, kind of things they don't need to know, but they may find interesting. But that's where I kind of stopped. With one exception, and that's in book three. And when I first say this, you're going to go, dear me, Gavin, you've gone from one extreme to the other. And what I do is I go, the three characters, they make an improvised hydrogen bomb. And
okay,
yeah, this is where it gets fun.
I'm sure the government, you know, will love that.
I'm sure they won't mind. But what I did, because I thought about it, I thought, you know what? If I put every step in, then basically, yeah, it could create a hell of a lot of problems. So what I've done is I've kind of said what's used and given a bit of an idea, but that's as far as it's gone, because basically, if we were to do it in say, cooking, and somebody said, well, how do you bake a cake? And I said, oh, you get some eggs and flour, and you heat the oven up, and you mix it all up and put it in the oven with a bit of sugar, and then you've got a cake. Anybody who cooks knows that's not how you make a cake. There's no time, there's no temperature, there's not all the ingredients and whatever else. And they would know, obviously, that wouldn't be enough to go off to make a cake. And that's pretty similar to what I've done with this improvised hydrogen bomb. I've said, you need a bit of this, a bit of that, and a bit of the other, and you know, you put these things together, and then, you know, it kind of goes boom. But not given enough information for anybody to be able to recreate it from what I've put in the book. So that's the extreme with that.
No, I'd say the readers don't understand perhaps how often that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Whether authors going, boy, do I really put things? I had explosive vests and dirty bombs, which was just a minor part of it. But, and of course, I'm searching, and NSA and FBI are loving my search history. But you know, you put just enough in there to say, this is, I'm making this thing, and I'm not going to tell you all these other things, but, you know, explosives and detonator and wires and button. And then the story goes on. It's not critical to the story to know how to make it. It's critical that it's there.
Yeah.
But I purposefully censored any great details for those particular things. Go find it yourself.
Yeah,
exactly. If you want to make one.
Yeah, and then that's kind of what I've done. I mean, like I say, all the other tradecraft, there's plenty of other stuff there. I mean, I think in one of the books I put how to make pepper spray, and, you know, which is really, really easy to do. So I put that in there. But the thing is, you can buy that over the counter in the US, in most states anyway. So it's not really anything that people can't already get a hold of. But, you know, like I say, things like that, I don't mind. IEDs, no. And then the other little thing when it comes to kind of limits, as it were, from experience, and again, you probably know this, it's when out there working in the field, you don't really have a choice of who you're working with. You can work with some really horrible people, and you have to pretend you like them, and, you know, and some, there are some really nasty characters that you have to be friends with. That's just life. It's just the way that the game goes. This is how we get the information that we get. Whereas obviously in the fiction world, your characters, there has to be a divide between the kind of people who are evil and people who are good, with not too much of a grey area. So, you know, the character, he's not going to be associating, for example, with child sex traffickers and utilising their services, because I didn't want to give the impression that this is the character and this is the kind of people he would do business with. But he would do business with somebody who forges documents and passports and that kind of thing. So, you know, I've tried to keep the character as ethically clean as possible for somebody who's technically an employed criminal. And unfortunately, as you know, that's not always the way it is in real life. We do have to deal occasionally with some really horrible people. But that's just life and the way it goes.
It's that way in radio too. Poor Joe has to deal with me.
Yeah, I know. Every time.
Pretend he likes
me. Yeah.
You said it, I didn't, pal.
Yeah. You said Gavin Stone was coming. He was probably, oh no. Can't you get me out of it?
Yeah. No, that's, yeah. He's like, why? No. So your characters, and I ask this of all fiction writers, what's your relationship with your characters? And I say that because, you know, I hear all sorts of things, like they're like family, friends, and they hear voices and all that stuff. And what's your experience with your character?
Well, like, the beauty of it for me is the fact that, you know, they are based on people I know. So it's kind of, sometimes I'll be writing and, I can hear what they're saying in the voices that they say it in, you know, like I'm sure you've heard so many times before. Even though they've never said these things to me, it's almost like it's a memory. It's absolutely crazy. But yeah, when I finish writing a book, it's almost like, oh, wow, I want to go back and do something with these guys now. And that's when I have to kind of call my friends up and say, hey, do you guys want to come for a game of pool or something, you know, just to kind of to escape the book and then get to the reality of it and get back to the people. And, you know, in the world we live in, We're all, I'm certainly getting a little bit older, and I'm finding as we all age and our kids are growing up and that kind of thing, time is a little bit more valuable, and it's harder to get the spare time of people like we used to be able to when we were younger.
Put your friends off. Have them react. Say, you know, by the way, Bernie, I'm killing you the next time. You are a good friend. But, you know what?
Easy, painful.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, Darius actually got shot, and he doesn't know it yet, but he's going to get shot again in book two or book three. So,
well, nobody likes Darius anyway. So,
yeah. But yeah, we're It does cause a little bit of a smile. We have banter and we have a laugh about it, and they call me up and they say, I can't believe, you know, you had me doing this or you had me doing that, which is great because the people who they're based on, they know it's them. The only downside to that is if ever I want that person to do something that is against their character in real life, it can cause animosity. I haven't had it yet, but I can imagine they'd be ringing up going, you've got to change this, I don't want to be known as somebody, or even read, you know, me doing this kind of thing. So this is advice for new writers out there. If you're going to base your characters on people you know, change the names and then don't tell them that it's them. That way you can get your characters to do anything you want rather than anything they want.
Becoming a writer and writing like you do, how has it changed you?
It's made me appreciate writers and books a hell of a lot more. It's something, I mean, I've read all my life and took it for granted that, you know, I've picked up these brilliant books and I've read them and gone, wow, you know, that was a great book. And you don't realise how much work goes into it. And that book has probably been rewritten maybe 50 times, edited, bits taken out, bits put in, chapters completely removed and changed, storylines completely changed. So it's given me a whole new appreciation for the author that I'm reading. And then for me, writing, it's made me realize exactly how difficult it is, because when I first wrote something, I had somebody take a look at it and she said, yeah, that's not a book, that's a report. You know, that was dreadful. You know, go and put some emotion and description into it. So I tried and several attempts and then eventually, she said, look, your action's good, your character's good, but there's not enough description. Really work on the description. So I went away and I tried again and I wrote the first chapter of another book and I handed it over. And she started reading it, this particular person, I'm not going to say who it is, and she started reading it and she went, you know what? She said, I'm 13 pages in. And she said, the description is that good that I didn't even realise that nothing's happening. You've come from one extreme to the other. You know, that your description is now great, but you've got no story, you know. And so getting that balance of action and description right can be very difficult, and you know, for any writers out there who've taken the time to try and you know, describe something and keep the story flowing, you know, they know and they realise how difficult it is to, you know, I mean, you look at, is it Tolkien who's how long did he spend describing a tree? You know, so it's something that finding that level ground of keeping the reader's interest, keeping them gripped to want to carry on reading, and also being descriptive enough for them to visualize what's happening. I didn't realize how much of a tightrope that was.
So where do people find Gavin? Are you on Facebook, social media? Do you have a website? You hang out in pubs? Like, where do people find you?
So online, yes, I do have a social media account, which is just Gavin Stone Author on Facebook. So you can follow me on there where there's loads of information going out for that. I do have a Twitter and an Instagram, but I don't really use them that much. However, I have a YouTube account. And I generally do a lot of videos with either people I've worked with in the intelligence industry or in the military or in that kind of thing. And we all jump on and we have all sorts of fun. Loads of different guests come on there with me. We talk about, there's former FBI guys, former KGB guys, former MI6, MI5, CIA. And we talk about all things, whether they've written books and they're talking about their books or whether it's just something they've done in the industry and we're sharing. We get on that. So YouTube, if you look on there, it's Gavin Stone Author. In person, if you go onto Eventbrite, I'm actually doing in July, I think it's July 15th, I'm doing a one-day spy skills workshop. So if anybody wants to come down and learn all the tradecraft I can cram into a day, we do everything from escape and evasion, lock picking, bypassing alarms and CCTV. We do human intelligence gathering and I just cram a day of tradecraft together. I've got that on Eventbrite. I'm not sure whether I'm going to continue doing it, but at the moment it's a little bit of fun. It's open to the general public and they can come down and they can do that. And if you're an author and you like to write from experience rather than imagining what it's like to feel that duct tape ripping your wrist hairs out and that kind of thing, you want to actually describe it with the memory, then it's perfect for you. You know, we do live weapons firing, we do disarming, we do all manner of different things, getting into safes the lot.
So after that, I know how to break into a place and not be detected. And you're going to tie me up with duct tape? Ooh, that's, I'm getting
yeah.
excited.
Yeah. Yeah.
We do it all.
Get the marijuana dispensary, then get tied up. You like that?
Yeah, we do a lot of zip ties, duct tape, handcuffs, the whole lot. So oh. it's like a kinky night, is it?
You know, but that's a Thursday night at Al's.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a party night at my house. Boy, I'll tell you. Yeah, I didn't know I could YouTube that. Maybe I can make money.
Well, I don't put it on YouTube, but I do kind of have the one. It's an in-person ticket event where people come along.
Where's it located?
So that I'm doing. I'm actually currently in the UK again for the time being, and that's happening in Kent on the 15th of July. I think there's a few spaces left on that particular one. And then if it goes reasonably well and the demand is there, then I might start doing them a little bit more frequently. And on the other hand, if people are, if it's not for them, I might call it a day. So I used to do them years ago, and they used to go reasonably well before I moved to the States. And I'm back in the UK for the time being, so I thought, well, I'll give it a shot again, see if people want to come and have a bit of fun.
Yeah, no, it sounds good. We'll have everything up on our website, too, so that people can find you quite easily. You know, it's not...
Oh, brilliant, thank
it's
you.
It's not going to be hard to find and all that stuff. So, and I also noticed that you were doing some event or some sort of thing about bullies, so that's important for you?
Yeah. So this is something that, again, it was a bit of a joint idea with a friend of mine from MI6. We were looking at kind of the spycraft skills course that I do, and we said, look, you know, that's a kind of a niche area for people who have an interest in it. And he said, look, with your skills and what you know and your background in psychology and body language and all the other things, can we look at a common problem that's going to help people who, you know, it's going to be like advantageous to them? And I thought one of the most common things, and I know because I have family members who have been through it drastically, have been bullied throughout their life. I know recently that there's people committed suicide and there's people with substance abuse and all manner of issues through bullying. And it's also something I've been on the receiving end of myself many years ago. And I thought, right, I'm going to put a little half day class together. And I'm going to teach people of like kind of secondary school level, like a parent and child combo, where they come along and I will say, right, I will teach you how to stop this without violence, without the usual tell the teacher tactics that don't really work and can actually make the problem worse. Sometimes it works, but, you know, if it doesn't, then your only lifeline is gone. I actually give them the techniques and the methods to be able to counter it and cut it out and stop it immediately.
Well, that's great. You use duct tape on that too?
No. Yeah, I could probably incorporate it one way or another, but no, this one's all psychological.
Well, this is great. We've learned a lot here. You know, Gavin, he sleeps with all of his characters and
hates his friends. I should him.
Yeah, he's right, you know. And he'll put you in a book and he'll do it all. You'll get it all. And then he has classes where he duct tapes you.
Yeah, why not? Who wouldn't want to pay to be tied up?
Well, you know.
Okay. I think it's time to cut this thing out. Yeah. Have a nice day with great weather.
Yeah, no. So now the book, of course, your latest book is called The Unforgiven Spy, and it's book one in the series of Spies for Hire. So Gavin Stone, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.